Hello everyone, thank you for joining us. In today's top story, Iran says the US, the UK and Israel are continuing their subversive plots against the country 45 years after supporting a deadly crackdown on the nation. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says the recent public meeting in London between the Israeli intelligence minister and anti-Iran figures is clear proof of the relentless scheming. Iran has repeatedly blamed the US, the UK and Israel for the deadly riots that broke out in the country last year. Nasser Kanani said the same, quote, sinister triangle supported the massacre on September 8, 1978 by the Pahlavi regime against an uprising which eventually led to the Islamic Revolution. The bloodshed in Tehran has come to be known as the Black Friday Massacre. Human rights activist Mohsen Naqvi says Israeli intelligence ministers' meeting with anti-Iran figures shows the regime's clear involvement in riots in Iran.
And the fact that the intelligence minister of Israel is meeting with these groups who have been responsible with the on-ground riots in Iran, especially in Tehran, so-called leaders of the groups kept on defending the riots by saying, or even other so-called human rights activists who were supporting these riots kept saying that this was an organic demonstration and it reflected upon the will of the people. This meeting in itself is enough evidence to prove the involvement that the Zionist regime had in exploiting the death of Mahsa Amini. And especially now that the one-year anniversary of Mahsa Amini's death is approaching, they plan on sinistering and planning something similar within Tehran. So clearly this was not, these protests are not a reflection of the Iranian will, but it is rather a scheme of the enemies of the Islamic Republic who are trying to exploit the death of an innocent young girl. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
Israeli forces have attacked anti-settlement protesters in the occupied West Bank, leaving dozens of Palestinians injured. The troops fired tear gas and rubber bullets at demonstrators in Kafqadum, east of Qalqilia. They also attacked protesters in several regions near the city of Nablus. Clashes also took place in Qariyut village as Israeli settlers backed by the regime forces staged a provocative raid there. Also, earlier on Friday, Israeli forces stormed Shufat refugee camp northeast of Al-Quds, removing Hamas flags and banners supporting the resistance movement. The raid triggered clashes with young Palestinian men, leaving dozens of them injured. Leaders of G20 countries gather in the Indian capital, New Delhi, for their annual summit on the weekend. The Group of 20 is an intergovernmental forum made up of the European Union and 19 rich countries. The two-day summit aims to address issues of global concern like economy, food and energy security, as well as the war in Ukraine. However, there are divisions at the G20 over those issues, especially the Ukraine war. That has already raised doubts whether participants would be able to put together a final declaration. The West, led by the US, wants a clear condemnation of the Ukraine conflict. China and Russia don't accept that. Plus, leaders from these two countries are not attending the summit. Instead, the Russian foreign minister and the Chinese premier are scheduled to attend. That makes things harder. Developing countries' repayment of their debts is another thorny issue in the event. Russia summons the ambassador of Armenia after the country announces plans to hold joint war games with the US. The Russian Foreign Ministry said in a statement that the drills on the Armenian territory are part of what it called a series of recent unfriendly steps by Yerevan. The ministry said those steps also include a trip to Kiev by the Armenian Prime Minister's wife amid Russia's war with Ukraine. Yerevan has also increased its criticism of Moscow's peacekeeping role in Nagorno-Karabakh. Armenia's prime minister recently said Russian forces have failed in their role to protect civilians and the freedom of movement in a key corridor in Azerbaijani-controlled areas in Karabakh. A new strike by airline and airport personnel has caused widespread disruptions in Italy, with tens of flights delayed or cancelled. We have a report from Rome.
On Friday, a 24-hour national strike was called by a number of base unions representing airline personnel, airport workers, and ground handlers in Italy. As a result of the industrial action, over 100 domestic and international flights were cancelled, with great delays recorded in a number of airports, including those of Milan, Venice, and Verona. It was the 18th strike involving airport and airline personnel in Italy this year. Travelers are feeling that they are left bearing the brunt of the clash between aviation sector companies and their workers.
They are not able to find a mutually satisfying deal. It must be said that workers have been deprived of their social rights over the past years.
I'm from Madrid. I just got here. I don't know if I'll be able to reach my destination today. It's very annoying.
Aviation sector workers have gone berserk as airline fares have skyrocketed over the past year and their salary levels have remained the same, if not worsened.
Union's main demand concerns airport ground service workers' collective agreement covering wages. The latest contract expired 6.5 years ago. In the meantime, inflation has really eaten into wages.
In our airports, we've got insecure, low-paid jobs which push workers into poverty. Some employees are forced to accept part-time jobs for less than 800 euros a month. Some others have to pay for parking their car in the workplace car parking areas, let alone their undignified working conditions. The logic behind this is the same as usual. Services offered at the cheapest rate. We have left the market in the hands of companies, and this is the result.
Goods and services prices in Italy have gone up dramatically since the start of the war in Ukraine. The 2022 annual inflation rate stood at over 8 percentage points, the highest level since 1985. Inflation stands at 6% today. A combination of high cost of living, skyrocketing costs of borrowing money, and insufficient fiscal support has caused a crunch that is felt at nearly every level in the country. Max Cibili, Rome.
The U.S. has confirmed that it seized a tanker containing nearly 1 million barrels of Iranian oil in April on the pretext of violation of anti-Iran sanctions. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the issue with our guests. Let's have the story and hear what our guests had to say. Welcome to the news review section, where we delve deeper into the day's top story. The U.S. has confirmed that it has seized a tanker load of Iranian oil, escalating tensions between the two sides. The Justice Department says it seized the Greek-managed tanker Suez Rajan and its load of nearly 1 million barrels of oil in April. The Iranian crude was allegedly being sold to China when it was intercepted. The U.S. claims the sale violated sanctions on Iran. Tehran has already warned of an appropriate response in case of any act of piracy against Iranian tankers, stressing that the era of hit and run is over. Now, to talk further on this, we are joined by Emeritus Professor of Accounting from California State University, Mr. Paul Foote. From Irvine, California, and also Mr. Don DeBar, activist and commentator from Ossining, New York City. First of all, welcome to the program, sir.
My pleasure.
Glad to have both of you on the program. Now, starting with Mr. Foote, now many people are calling the U.S. seizure of the Iranian oil tanker, which is worth around $56 million, they call it a classic example of broad daylight banditry. Your idea on this, sir?
Well, that's absolutely correct that America is currently being led by organized crime. But people need to read some history. This is nothing new. The media in this country is now saying, well, we're taking it from the Revolutionary Guard. Nonsense. You're taking it from the people of Iran. Read some history. In the 1800s, there was the Reuters concession, where a weak Shah agreed to give away most of the oil to benefit himself. Early 1900s, there was the Darcy concession. Same thing. And then the British American The British Petroleum, British Iranian Petroleum Company, is now BP, was taking oil and giving almost nothing from the proceeds to Iran. So the theft has been taking place for more than 100 years against Iranians. The techniques have changed. The current technique is to claim that America has a right to issue sanctions. America is supposed to be a country of free enterprise, capitalism. The people currently in power, such as Biden and all the supporters of Israel, are anti-capitalist and enemies of the American people.
That's right, sir. Now, Mr. Donderbar, it took the cargo, or the U.S., to transfer the cargo to another tanker. It was named MR Euphrates. It took them 4 months of dilly-dallying. Why was the reason for this?
Well, first of all, the taking of this, the legal process around seizing someone else's property is called civil forfeiture in the United States. And the location of this particular seizure, Texas, is the worst abuser of this process. They're noted for the abusive process. People driving through Texas would get pulled over for speeding, and the next thing in their Maserati, and the next thing you know, the sheriff has a Maserati. It was really that bad. Professor was right. The foundational law here, which is the assumption that the United States can impose sanctions on one country, prohibiting them from doing business with another, flies in the face of international law. There's no authority for that under the UN Charter or anything flowing from the UN Charter. The U.S. has no right to interfere with commerce between Iran and any other country in the world. This is just not something that is recognized under international law. The legal term for what the U.S. has done is called piracy. I mean, this is as much piracy as if Joe Biden was staggering around on a wooden leg with a parrot on his shoulder. And we're talking about a million gallons of oil. What's the price of crude go now? You're talking tens of millions of dollars. This is major theft. It's one of many. If you look at Libya's oil, Iraq's oil, Syria's oil, even now, being illegally stolen from Syria in direct violation of international law and at gunpoint, it's hard to come to any other conclusion than the United States is a pirate state out stealing things at gunpoint from every other country in the world that it can take over. If you look at oil, Venezuela and Iran are two that resist, and they're under heavy sanctions, and the others were conquered. Iraq, Libya, that's what the United States is. And you have to see this in that context. I don't see any other context for it.
Mr. Foote, like Mr. Donderbar said about piracy, it's been looting Syrian oil, Libyan oil. Syria, the Syrian oil ministry accused the U.S. of stealing 66,000 barrels of oil per day, which is around 80% of the country's oil production. So how can this happen in 2023 without any consequences?
It's the problem of the ignorance of the American voters. They rely on the mainstream media, which is dominated by Zionists. They're ignorant. They don't know what's going on. And they have no understanding of capitalism and moral values. This is theft. We should not be involved in this kind of theft. You can add Ukraine to the list, too. On and on, we're just throwing away America's wealth and making enemies around the world and bringing closer the day when no one will want to do anything with us. Thanks to the lunatic leftists, the neoconservatives, and the Christian Zionists in this country.
Before we wrap this up, Mr. Donderbar, Iran said or warned of an appropriate response. It's also said the era of hit and run is over. So what does Tehran mean by this?
You know, I mean, this is also a provocation, obviously. And this comes right after the BRICS conference, the ascension, the partnering of Iran and others, the rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia. and the outreach that Iran and Venezuela have done to each other, that shows that they can saber rattle all they want. They could steal a few more boatloads of oil. But the world is changing, and they're going to have to deal with that. And as long as there's solidarity among the countries that are the victims of these sanctions, and worse, then the position of the United States will be, in essence, rendered impotent. And, you know, when you have all the oil, you get to set the terms for the sale of it. And, you know, they might be having a hissy fit about that right now, but they're going to have to deal with this. So I would say Iran should be patient, you know, have obviously hold up its dignity, but be patient because the world is shifting in its favor.
That's right, sir. Mr. Foote, Mr. Dondebaugh, thank you for being on the program, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. And with that, we come to the end of the News Review program.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Standing shoulder to shoulder with the BRICS member countries, the Islamic Republic of Iran has yet again demonstrated to the world that the nation must never abandon its principles in order to forge ahead. With Iran's diplomatic successes, technological breakthroughs, and favorable geopolitical conditions, the nation is more enabled than ever to advance its external interests and, as a result, improve its internal conditions as well. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, "America can't do a damn thing against us," said Imam Khomeini shortly after the groundbreaking Islamic Revolution of 1979 that he spearheaded. The Islamic Republic of Iran continues to prove his immortal words true. Imam Khomeini's worthy successor and leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, often repeats these words with extraordinary conviction. Considering that Iran has been in the crosshairs of the U.S. war machine since the very onset of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, it is a remarkable feat that the proud Iranian nation continues to march ahead at a galloping pace despite crippling sanctions. In fact, if 2023 was any nation's year, it would certainly be the Islamic Republic of Iran. The pragmatic and progressive foreign policy of President Ebrahim Raisi has enabled the Islamic Republic to forge powerful ties from Latin America to Africa all the way to Far East Asia. Through these new alliances, the Islamic Republic of Iran has inked many trade deals, from energy to medical technologies, particularly keeping countries that are also targeted by U.S. war hawks very close Venezuela, Cuba, and Russia, just to name a few. Pushing the envelope even further this year was Iran's entry into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, and finally the golden ticket, an invitation and acceptance into the BRICS group of emerging economies. Iran's current administration has enabled the Islamic Republic to uncover limitless pathways to trade and development, as well as potential security alliances, demonstrated by joint military drills with Russia and China. Though President Raisi's remarkable foreign policy does indeed deserve a standing ovation from every anti-imperialist, these achievements would not come to fruition if it were not for the mission and principles of the Islamic Revolution itself. Since day one of the revolution, Iran has committed itself to not only self-determination as a nation, but to uniting the Muslim community and worldwide to breaking the grip of imperialist colonialist powers within the region and beyond, and of course, the complete and total liberation of Palestine. This has not been an empty political rhetoric. Iran has very much walked the talk. Just take a look at the late anti-terror commander, General Qasem Soleimani's illustrious life and legacy. The Soleimani doctrine wasn't limited to just the deployment of Quds Force and Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, against threats to Iran's borders. General Soleimani, representing the very principles of the Islamic Revolution, was on the front lines in Syria and Iraq, fighting side by side with the Syrian Arab Army, Hezbollah Resistance Group, and Iraq's Popular Mobilization Forces against Daesh terrorists and American-backed proxies. The famed anti-terror commander would often meet with Palestinian resistance leaders, training their forces and facilitating rocket development to enable them to fight the Israeli occupation forces. In a world system dominated by the imperialist West, these actions would come with severe consequences. The U.S. placed sanctions on not only the IRGC, which General Soleimani represented, but on various Iranian enterprises that directly impacted thousands of ordinary Iranian people. Donald Trump administration pulled out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, commonly known as the Iran Nuclear Deal, and labeled the IRGC a terrorist group a year later, inflicting more unjust and illegal sanctions. These are just some examples of Iran's independent pursuits and the West's diabolic response within a small time frame. Throughout the decades, there were many attempts by foreign powers to force Iran out of pursuing its revolutionary goals. Who can forget former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's imposed 8-year war on Iran, militarily backed by a far-right-led United States and a decaying Soviet Union? Or former U.S. President George Bush naming Iran in his infamous Axis of Evil speech, followed by increasing U.S. hostilities around Iran's borders? And of course, just in recent memory, who can forget the West's wide chorus of support for foreign plotted riots that briefly shook Iran in late 2022, only 2 years after the West imposed maximum pressure sanctions during the COVID-19 pandemic, killing scores of those very same women the West allegedly speaks for. Time and time again, Iran has stood up for what is right and just and has been met with shockingly murderous, too, downright genocidal responses from the West. The pain felt by Iranians cannot be ignored, but all the same, their tenacity and unflinching determination to carry forward the torch of the revolution cannot either. While other Muslim nations have had their leaders pursue normalization with the Israeli occupation, Iran doubled down on support both politically and materially for Palestine. While some leaders sacrificed their people's resources to the predatory capitalists of the West, Iran invested in self-dependence. While some leaders in Asia brazenly shook hands with the West and let their land and resources be used for America's imperialist conquest, Iran prepared a meticulous counterweight in the form of various Islamic resistance organizations. While other countries now have blood on their hands and are buried under the weight of predatory debtors, Iran has emerged victorious, never abandoning the original commitments to the Islamic revolution. It is this tenacity and commitment to the revolution founded by Imam Khomeini and carried forward by Ayatollah Khamenei. After all, it is an Islamic revolution, and the revolution itself is far from complete. Israeli regime still oppresses Palestinians. Americans are still embedded deep within Syria and Iraq. Western mercenaries and spies run amok from Lebanon to Pakistan. And the West mechanisms still threaten the complete unity of Muslims worldwide. By God, I will never surrender to my enemies like a humiliated person and never pledge allegiance to them like slaves. These words from Imam Hussein, peace upon him, accurately convey the message of Iran's orientation to its foes. And thus, this outlook is a cornerstone of the Islamic Republic's foreign policy. This sheer revolutionary fervor has now placed Iran, despite all odds and opposition, on the world stage. Iran's newfound successes will without a doubt be met with new challenges. The imperialist enemies of Iran will feel more threatened by the rising Islamic nation's success and will feel inclined to lash out, whether that be through economic warfare, sabotage, or other means. Nothing Iran isn't used to or already counting on. Indeed, America can't do a damn thing.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, let us reflect on a bezel of wisdom from Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Sitting with the intelligent is a sign of success. Disputation with other than disbelievers is a sign of ignorance. While a sign of a scholar is his self-criticism of his sayings and his acquaintance with the various hypotheses. Thank you.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, asking for forgiveness leads to a pure heart, and a pure heart leads to a Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. This is A to Z, and we are talking about how asking for forgiveness leads to a pure heart, and of course, a pure heart leads to a Islamic lifestyle. Now, when we are talking about asking for forgiveness, of course, you know, some of us perhaps unconsciously or unknowingly will commit sins or will commit errors, will commit mistakes when it comes to a Islamic lifestyle. Now, we're not saying that this is normal. Committing sins is actually abnormal. What's interesting is that in the society and the era that we live in, unfortunately, we believe or we think or we imagine that committing sins is something that is normal, when in reality, it is not normal. It is abnormal to commit sins, and to commit sins is actually outside of our nature, of what, you know, we are created as by the Almighty Allah. So regardless, you know, some one way or the other, we might end up committing sins, whether knowingly or unknowingly. Now, what sins do is that they tarnish the heart. We had said in previous programs that the heart is this metaphysical center of a human being. If the heart is pure, then the actions become pure, and of course, living a Islamic lifestyle is much easier, and it becomes easier, and it becomes pleasurable and satisfying. But if the heart is impure, then living a Islamic lifestyle becomes very difficult. One becomes lazy in trying to live a Islamic lifestyle, and sometimes one might go the other way, in the exact opposite direction. And so having a pure heart is really important when it comes to living a Islamic lifestyle. One of the things that purifies the heart, of course, is asking for forgiveness. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about how having a pure heart leads to living a Islamic lifestyle. Now, of course, this is really important. We're all trying to live that Islamic lifestyle, and we are all trying to attain that eternal bliss, and we are trying to attain that salvation and that happiness, both in this world and the next. So if we want to attain that eternal happiness in the next life, and we want to live a good, happy life in this current worldly realm, then we're going to have to live a Islamic lifestyle. I guarantee you, and the Almighty Allah guarantees you, that if you don't live a Islamic lifestyle, your life will be quite miserable, and one day or the other, that miserableness will show itself. But anyways, living that Islamic lifestyle is really what will bring us true happiness in both this world and the next. So what do we do in order to attain that Islamic lifestyle? Well, our heart needs to be in it. And our heart will be in that Islamic lifestyle. It will be eager to live that Islamic lifestyle if it is pure, if it is clean, if it is healthy, metaphysically speaking. And how do we make that heart clean and pure and healthy and wholesome? Well, one of the ways is to ask for forgiveness. And as we had said, we might have committed sins knowingly or unknowingly, consciously or subconsciously. And so on a regular basis, if not on a daily basis, if we ask the Almighty Allah for forgiveness, a sincere forgiveness, you know, that we don't want to disobey the Almighty Allah, and we're going to try our best to not continue to disobey the Almighty Allah, this asking for forgiveness will purify our hearts, it will cleanse our hearts, and that pure heart will in turn lead to wanting to live a Islamic lifestyle. So if you want to live a Islamic lifestyle, make sure to ask for forgiveness from the Almighty Allah.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
While the Israeli occupying entity is still reliving the horror of the shock left by the successive commando operations in the West Bank, the enemy army has carried out since Friday several incursions into the villages in the West Bank. Zionist Israelis continue its attempt to eradicate the resistance cells in the West Bank, but all attempts so far are failing and are met with more confrontation and an escalation of commando operations. The flaming difficult scene for the Israeli entity was not limited to the events in Nablus and Ramallah, but different regions of the West Bank also witnessed a series of operations within a period of 24 hours last week, all of which had equal significance. The series of operations began with the running over of a soldier south of Al-Khalil Hebron on Wednesday afternoon, followed by a stabbing operation in occupied Al-Quds. As for the most important event, it was represented by the IED that exploded with the occupation forces in the city of Nablus, resulting in the injury of an officer and three soldiers. In addition, four illegal colonial settlers were injured after Molotov cocktails and stones were thrown at their vehicles near Qalqilia, and armed clashes took place in more than one location in the West Bank, which resulted in the injury of a soldier in the village of Kfarzan near Jenin, and the death of a soldier and the wounding of five others in a run-over operation near Ramallah. For the Israeli entity's security establishment, the danger of run-over operations, which indicates the development of the performance of the fighters in terms of their competence, good planning, and accurate implementation, is no less than the danger of the phenomenon of explosive devices. However, like the previous explosives that were detonated in the Jenin and Nur Shams camps in an organized and controlled manner, the Nablus explosive device received great attention in the Zionist circles, as it was reported that it contained unusual or rarely used explosive materials. In any case, explosive devices have become a real phenomenon in Palestinian camps and villages and cities, and the fighters have succeeded in reproducing and activating their manufacture, leading to the detonation of one of them on Thursday morning in one of the military jeeps in the town of Zabadde near Jenin, which prompted the occupation army to enforce curfew and close the town. This signifies the continuous escalation of resistance operations in the West Bank, especially in light of the enemy's increasing threats to assassinate leaders in the resistance, like Sheikh Saleh Al-Aruri, in response to what is happening in the West Bank. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The occupation army had barely slept on a difficult security event in the city of Nablus at dawn on Wednesday until it woke up to a very difficult operation near Ramallah. Now, the two events, even if they differed in the method of implementation, they confirmed one fact. This is the escalation of resistance operations and the failure of all attempts by the occupation to prevent it, which threatens to lose control over the occupied West Bank. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Maryam Mohammed, political commentator. Thanks a million for being with us. Ms. Maryam, now, different areas of the West Bank witnessed a series of commando operations within a period of 24 hours last week, especially in Ramallah and Nablus, all of which predicted that the commando operations of the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank is only starting a new wave of escalation against the Zionist occupation. But is a valid question is this an indicator that the Zionist entity might treat Nablus and Ramallah the same way it treated Jenin?
Thank you very much, Marwa, for having me, and greetings to everyone. You know, the Israelis themselves don't really seem to know where they are going or where things are going, given their internal turmoil and the way that the Palestinians are running things against them, which is homogeneous in the general context, but let's say heterogeneous or unpredictable in the execution and the details. There's a really interesting contradiction that I would like to highlight here, which is that Netanyahu during the past government used to criticize and accuse that government of restraining the hand of the army. And he would blame this to be the reason behind the failure in what they describe as restoring calm. Now, where we are now, it is Netanyahu's government. It is a far-right government. They have unleashed the hand of the army. They unleashed the hand of their settlers, and they led a wide invasion of Jenin. And what did they really accomplish or achieve? Well, during their withdrawal from Jenin, they were facing a Palestinian attack in the 1948 occupied Palestinian territories. So let's ask this now. Did they really handle Jenin so to wonder or to see if they are really able to handle other occupied Palestinian territories in the same way? According to their military analysts and media, no. But, I mean, then who know what they might actually do? Because, as I said in the beginning, the Israelis themselves don't seem to have a clear strategy in dealing with the current situation now.
Well, I can hear that clearly, but it was a nightmare of car ramming and explosive devices that is chasing the Zionist occupation army, especially the new IEDs that we are witnessing used by the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank, which have turned the occupation army vehicles into a trap for the soldiers because these vehicles cannot withstand these Palestinian-made bombs. What kind of an effect, in your opinion, do you think this will have on the morale of the occupation forces that are now being pushed further into new cities in the West Bank after they got it hard in Jenin?
Well, to be very honest, I'm not really a military expert to be able to precisely describe how this affects their readiness or their tactics and morale, but it definitely casts a very heavy shadow on their military institution. And we can see this, a proof to this would be that they are now deploying methods that they haven't deployed in over 2 decades, for example, the use of Apache in the invasion of Jenin, and as well as using drones to assassinate Palestinian youth in the West Bank as young as 16, 17 years old. I was reading a few months ago an article in the Washington Institute that was actually describing those IEDs to the ones used by the resistance in Lebanon during the Israeli occupation of South Lebanon. This alone, I think, is a nightmare for them because it reminds them of how effective these IEDs were and how those the effectiveness of those in speeding up their defeat and withdrawal from Lebanon. And also this article made another comparison, which was an indirect indicator how high the level of the current Palestinian attacks are now in comparison to those in the second Palestinian Intifada. And this also is another nightmare because it kind of tells them that they have lost everything that they think they have achieved or accomplished since 2 decades until now. And I would like to finally note that the IEDs alone don't seem to be currently the worst nightmare or the only nightmare because there is also the change in Palestinian tactics. Currently, we are seeing that Palestinian resistance fighters are no longer detonating a bomb and just withdrawing immediately, but rather they stay and they engage in battle before withdrawing. And one final note is that also there's a development and a very big threat that is now looming for the Israeli occupation, which is a first attempt that was made a few weeks ago to launch a locally manufactured rocket from the West Bank to the Israeli settlements in the West Bank.
Well, definitely all these new developments are being highly talked about and being a point of focal point in the Zionist entity, especially in the media. But the Zionist entity itself, I mean the security establishment itself, it realizes that any upcoming confrontation will not be confined within the Palestinian borders. It will go ahead to more border lines. And perhaps this is what prompted Netanyahu, like you said at the beginning, to rush to convene the cabinet, which was scheduled for September. He scheduled it even before September started to discuss the Israeli occupation army's preparations for what he called a multi-front war, which allegedly, according to him, is being led by the Islamic Republic of Iran. That being said, the Zionists cannot seem to be able to handle the Palestinian resistance, which, by the way, is doing a great job, but they can't seem to handle only that front on its own. So are they going to be able to handle that multi-front that Netanyahu is talking about?
Yes, you know, Marwa, the Israelis a few decades ago were very loud and proud about their invincible army and how they are able to defeat several armies at one time. Well, what happened is then they were defeated by the resistance movements in Lebanon and they had to withdraw from Lebanon. And afterwards came their defeat and withdrawal from Gaza as well. Yet they still believed in the superiority of their military and their ability to defeat. And here came their biggest blow in the 2006 Israeli war against Lebanon. Now, after this, the Israelis were then running away from every crisis towards attacking Gaza. And when Gaza started defeating them, they were then waging wars on Gaza that were targeted against only one resistance faction at a time. With even this not working out for them, and they even moved to attacking or waging battles and wars on individuals in the West Bank. So with even this not working for them and with the diminishing or deterioration in the deterrence of their army and effectiveness, how could they really handle a multi-front war? And not to forget that the multi-front war speculations are coming now with an additional layer of threat for them, which is the internal chaotic situation they are facing. And I see that this is also an additional front they are currently fighting at, and which, according to their military experts, is damaging the army a lot and is also lessening its effectiveness and its readiness to face any battle currently. Mm-hmm. As
definitely,
they say.
Definitely, definitely. We are seemingly approaching an era where the Zionist entity does not know where the next blow will hit it. I want to thank you very much, Ms. Maria Muhammad, political commentator, for joining us to discuss the new developments that the Palestinian resistance is using, especially in the West Bank. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about what is really going on inside the eastern part of Syria.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, the regions of eastern Syria are witnessing active American movements in parallel with Russian-Syrian movements. Although the region was not far from tensions over the past years, but the Americans and the Russians were still able to avoid a clash, while the movement of the Syrian army against the American forces remained within certain limits. But now it seems that the tension at this stage have indeed exceeded the usual level of engagement. More details in the following report.
Since the clashes erupted east of the Euphrates River between the Kurdish separatists known as the Syrian Democratic Forces, SDF, and the forces of the Deir ez-Zor Military Council, questions multiply in various circles as to what is happening there, what are the objectives of these clashes, and the consequences of it. The clashes were not limited to Deir ez-Zor, as the Manbij area in the eastern countryside of Aleppo entered the line of confrontation between the Kurdish separatists and the tribal fighters. In conjunction with the expansion of the battlefield in the countryside of Deir ez-Zor all the way to the eastern countryside and the Iraqi borders. With the withdrawal of the Kurdish separatists from a number of cities and towns in that region, calls were made to open fronts against it in Raqqa and Hasake to relieve pressure on the Deir ez-Zor countryside front. The Turkish-backed National Army, in turn, announced the opening of crossings from its areas of control in the direction of the Manbij area for all clans wishing to attack the SDF headquarters, while supporting them with the required weapons and equipment. This offensive, in parallel with the confusion of the SDF in confronting it, prompted a Russian intervention by carrying out several air raids on the villages that witnessed attacks. Meanwhile, the people of the eastern countryside began an uprising against the SDF, which led to the loss of most of the villages and towns of this countryside within a few hours. Tribal fighters were able to control the towns of As-Suhail, Diban, Al-Jardi, At-Tayana, and Hajin, all the way to Al-Baghouz on the Iraqi border, while seizing weapons, equipment, and military vehicles, including U.S. Army Humvees and Hummers used by SDF. The fighters also seized weapons and ammunition depots while the SDF members turned themselves into the clansmen, after giving them a deadline to vacate their headquarters before attacking them. On the other hand, and in an attempt to obtain more support from the Americans for its campaign in Deir ez-Zor, the SDF's media center issued a statement accusing the Syrian government of facilitating the passage of fighters from the western bank of the Euphrates River to strike security and stability in the eastern countryside of Deir ez-Zor after providing them with equipment and weapons. Now, the United States did not lose sight of leading the rhythms of the clashes in the eastern Euphrates region, where it is leading these rhythms in an attempt to establish a new reality on the ground. The U.S. Central Command even issued a statement expressing its concern about the ongoing developments in Deir ez-Zor, calling on, quote, all parties to stop the escalation and resolve the situation peacefully, unquote. But when has peace ever been attained where the United States has a military occupation base? I'll answer that. Never.
Now, Now to discuss this issue with us from Atlanta, Georgia, is Mr. Aqil Hananu, political commentator, researcher, and writer. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Aqil Hananu. Now, the current clashes in eastern Syria does not only arise from the political and military position of the Kurdish separatists, but also that the so-called SDF placed its hand on the oil and gas, basically all the resources of the Syrian Arab Republic, obviously with the help of the United States of American occupation, in addition to wheat as well, which made it control basically the economic paths in the area, which also, by default, marginalized the Arab tribes in the area. Is that the main reason for the recent flare-up, let us say, following that some of these Arab tribes already had maybe participated with Daesh, fought against the Syrian government to begin with, but now they have turned their guns on SDF?
Well, to be honest with you, I think that the conflict in the northern part of Syria, it goes beyond the Kurds and the tribe. It's a plan implemented by the occupier, being Turkey and United States together. They just need to keep that area in turmoil, so no peace and no harmony could happen. The Kurds, as you said, are the agent of the American occupation in that area, and they were implementing its the American policy in the neighborhood. Now there is a changes coming up after most of the war in the most part of Syria has ended, but the conflict itself, it's not. The war changed tools from military attack against the Syrian land and the government into economic one. And that economic war is at worst. And the people in Syria in general, not only in the northern part of Syria, suffering because of stealing the resources of the Syrian land. What's going on between the tribe and the Kurds is right now they have a meeting conducted by the American embassy in Damascus, even though the American embassy is closed, but its representatives still claim the responsibility of taking care of things inside Syria through their agent. So a couple of days ago yesterday or day before yesterday, the representative of the American embassy in Syria had a meeting between the tribe, the Arab tribe, and the Kurds trying to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. But the problem is not going to be solved because both party has been supported by the same occupier, which is the United States and Turkey. They just need to keep the problem going on. Until now, we did not see that, for example, among the Arab tribe, we have not seen in any of their statement the national Syrian flag. So we are still waiting to see, after this conflict settled between them and the Kurds, to what party are they going to be belonging? What party are they going to claim to be part of their goals? Mm-hmm. So are we still waiting? But this is not the end of it.
I would, if bets were halal, I would bet on the party that's actually giving weapons for both sides.
Correct.
But Turks, you mentioned Turkey. The Turks are obsessed with the Kurdish experience, as we know, that might extend to the Turkish interior, which they might view today as an opportunity to invade more of the land in northern Syria, whose border can reach up to 70 kilometers to the southern part of Turkey, and they are thus relying on the Arabs, which they have been training, that they have been arming for the past 12 years now, as substitutes to the Kurds in that region. Is this maybe Turkish, the full version of the Turkish return to the Western alliance against Syria, or rather, this might be a window of possibility to open new ties and new talks with the Syrian government?
Well, I think the leadership of Turkey know very well nobody could control those borders except the Syrian government. But what they are trying to do is trying to get rid of as much Kurds as they can. The idea of a separate enclave of Kurds in Syria not only threatened Turkey, it threatened Turkey, Syria, and Iran. The creation of the Kurdistan in Iraq was done with 500,000 American soldiers in Iraq when they occupied that country. So repeating the same story in Syria will be a threat to the national security of Turkey and Iran, and obviously of Syria. So whether they say it openly or not, all those three countries are in agreement to prevent any enclave of Kurds in Syria. Now, the way they are going about it, is different. Syria is trying to take those Kurds and get them back onto the right path to cooperate with the Syrian government, because at the end of the day, the Syrian government will never accept any independent enclave of Kurds or any other race or religion on Syria. So what they are doing right now, they are trying to weaken the Kurds to the point they are being used as a chip between the politics of United States and Turkey. Turkey will never be outside the umbrella of the NATO. Everybody thinks because Turkey went and start cooperating with Russia and start the signing treaty with Russia and here and there, that they are getting out of the Western alliance. That will never happen. As long as the army is equipped with American weaponry and their economy depend on the trade with Europe and United States, they will never be at odds with the Western policy.
Well, obviously, from what you're saying, Mr. Hanano, the American factor is the strongest factor in east of the Euphrates inside of Syria, as it is the first...